Geneva.
New York City has agreed to pay the federal government $70 million to settle a lawsuit that accused the city of overbilling the Medicaid program. NPR's Mike Pesca has details.
The city estimates that almost 20,000 residents received 24-hour personal care services over the last decade. These services, which include grooming and shopping, are supposed to be approved by a panel of professionals. The city admits that didn't always happen. The federal government brought suit under the False Claims Act, which would have tripled damages if New York were found in violation. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
A jetliner on a flight from Newark, New Jersey, has made an emergency landing in Warsaw after the landing gear failed to open. The plane, operated by Polish airline LOT, skidded to a landing on its belly. No passengers were injured. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
The Wampanoag Nation saved the Pilgrims from starvation and lived to regret it. We Still Live Here, our next community cinema, tells the story of linguist Jesse Littledoe reviving the Wampanoag language more than a century after the last native speaker died. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, November 8th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring the Vienna Symphony Orchestra with the Eroica Trio for an exciting evening of Beethoven and Brahms on Tuesday, November 8th. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And in the first hour today, we'll be talking about something that I know has great power to fascinate people and has for a long time. We'll be talking about mummies. Now, when we see a mummy, when we visit a museum and see one, we certainly recognize that this thing is more than just an archaeological artifact. It's a person. And we wonder, who was this person, and how did they live, and perhaps how did they die? Scientists who investigate the past are using modern tools in an effort to answer questions like that. And this morning, we'll be talking with a couple of people who are have some expertise in this field. David Hunt from the Smithsonian Institution, and Sarah Wissman. She's director of the Program on Ancient Technologies and Archaeological Materials here at the University of Illinois. And we will also talk some about some recent investigative work done on a mummy here at the university, at the Spurlock Museum. Maybe if you have seen the New York Times, you've seen a mention of that fact, and the fact that there will be a symposium to talk about that on the campus tomorrow. And also this afternoon, Dr. Hunt will be giving a talk, and I'll tell you about that a little bit later on here. Just very quickly, I want to mention our guest, David Hunt. He's a museum specialist. He works at the National Museum of Natural History in the Department of Anthropology at the Smithsonian. And Sarah, as I said, is director of the Program on Ancient Technologies and Archaeological Materials. She's also a writer. She has authored four mysteries that are archaeological in nature. At least they have an archaeologist as the protagonist. She's also written a book that if you're interested in mummies, you might want to look at, a book that is about the University of Illinois mummy that's titled The Virtual Mummy, and it's published by the U of I Press. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You want to send us an email, you can do that. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much for being here. You know, I want to ask a question about about why it is that mummies are so fascinating. I think I know the answer, but I'm interested in having you give me your answer.
Well, I know when I've given tours at the Spurlock Museum, and I love sixth graders the best because they are so responsive, mm-hmm. Their first question always is there a real person in here? So you nailed it. It's because it's not a pot or an axe or something like that. It's a human being. And they find that absolutely fascinating, and they find it even creepier when I can look back at them and say, yes, and this person was about your age.
That I suppose that imposes special kinds of conditions, maybe, where as you things that you think about when you deal with that, because it's not a pot, right?
Oh, true. Yes. You have to consider it in the sense that it is a human being or was a human being, and that you treat that in that regard. And our investigations are ones in which we, these days, try to be as non-invasive as possible in its study.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the World Mummy Congress that both Dave and I attended in San Diego in June, one of the very first discussions was about the ethics of studying mummies. So we had a very good discussion about how to find the right balance between scientific investigation and paying respect to the dead person and the culture from which it comes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get into some of these questions. Let me ask a more basic kind of question. When people hear that word, mummy, they think of Egypt and they think of that culture and its very elaborate rituals surrounding preservation of the dead. There, though, I think is more to it than that, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Different cultures throughout the world have preserved their ancestors in many different ways, but mummification or desiccation of the body so that you have more of it than just the skeletal remnants is a practice that's been seen throughout the world. And so that's one thing when people think about mummies. Of course, we have been exposed primarily to Egypt and Egyptian mummies, but mm-hmm. you find them throughout the world.
So technically, a mummy is just a body, a human body that has been preserved, whether that was intentional or whether that was, in a sense, accidental because of the conditions of the place where the body was.
Yes, I think some of the best-known examples would be the Peruvian mummy bundles from the high Andes, and I think Nova did a special years ago on the Peruvian ice maiden. And the other one that comes to mind, one of the most famous, is the Austrian-Italian iceman, mm-hmm. who's now, they decided he belongs to Italy, so he's in a museum in Bolzano, and he's nicknamed mm-hmm. Ozzy. Mm-hmm.
I just, in fact, I came across some fairly recent articles about him. The scientists have continued to do investigation and draw what kind of conclusions they did about who this was and what were the circumstances of his death. And apparently there are all sorts of things that they, including what he had for his last meal, that they have learned from studying him.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm.
Dave can tell you a good story about the X-ray technology and the change in research on the cause of death.
Well, yeah. For Ötzi, one of the changes in technology that came from that was early CT scans that were done of his body back in the early 90s. The machinery was only able to do, say, down to about 2-millimeter slices, and it took so long that in generally what they did is they did the 2-millimeter slices through the skull, but then from shoulder down they did it at 10 millimeters. Well, in that initial scan that came from that, they missed the projectile point that was embedded in the shoulder because it was between the two 10-millimeter slices. It wasn't until subsequent research where they rescanned it at a 1-millimeter slice system did they find this, find the projectile point, which, of course, led to other speculations on what his last days were like or what his cause of death may
likely have been. Not an accident.
Maybe not.
Yeah. That's also a great argument and is really the reason why we re-CAT scanned our mummy after a 20-year gap, because the technology is so much better and the resulting images are so much crisper and cleaner, and that's because they're higher resolution and the slices are much closer together.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Then you have at the Spurlock Museum, there is a mummy that has been in the custody of the University of Illinois for a number of years. And as you said, in 1990, you took it to a local clinic here and they did a CT scan. What was it that you learned at that point? You know, what did you know in 1990 about that mummy that you hadn't known before?
Okay, when we first received the mummy, all we knew was that it came from the Fayum Oasis District of Egypt, which is where Greek and Roman settlers set up camp and lived for some time. And we didn't know a specific site or tomb. We knew from looking at the front of the mummy that it belongs stylistically to the Roman period, and that's because it has a Roman-style face portrait and then Egyptian gods and other symbols marching down the front. So stylistically, it appeared to be about 100 AD. But the World Heritage Museum at the time invited us to study the mummy non-destructively because they wanted to put it back on display. So we started with X-rays at the large animal clinic on campus and the first set of scans at Carle Foundation Hospital, which is the same place we went back in March. And from what we learned from those two sets of images is that the mummy is not an adult. It is a child, and from looking at the ends of the long bones, which were not fused, and the tooth development, people at that time narrowed it.
Participating in the test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
There's a little bit of damage around the feet, and it was possible to collect a couple of insects without doing any damage to the mummy. Those are necrobic or flesh-eating beetles. So they're not the kind of beetle that is common in old storage rooms in modern times, the museum beetle, but actual flesh-eating beetle implying that either this was a crummy mummy, they did a bad job of embalming, or some other way these bugs got inside.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of the big questions that at the time people were interested in was, what could you say what the gender was? Was this a boy or a girl? You know that it was an individual somewhere between 7 and 9. So you want to know, was this a boy or a girl? And if you could, was there some kind of insight possibly into what the cause of death was? So now you've done another scan. You have a little bit more detail. Do you have answers to either of those questions?
We have a lot more detail. We have better images. Unfortunately, we do not have the answer to the question of sex. And in addition to looking at the images, we also asked Ripon Mahli at the Department of Anthropology to run a DNA test on one of the foot bones that had fallen out of the bottom of the mummy. And alas, that's negative. And he says it's very difficult to get authentic DNA from something that old. And then you also have the problem of contamination from the embalming fluids. But David here can tell you a little bit more about the difficulties we had examining the pelvis of this child. So I'll let you pick up on that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the things that you, in a forensic anthropology or skeletal biology realm, sexing the child from the skeleton is pretty inaccurate to do prior to puberty, around 13 or 14 years of age. Also, the pelvis is still in its developmental stages and has not fused together completely before 13 or 14 years of age. So making measurements, which you can do on the living, can't be done generally, as in particular, in this particular instance, the mummy, because the pelvis has collapsed some during the time of the embalming, that you can't take those measurements. And so to try to get the sex of the individual would be nearly impossible to do. We were talking a little bit earlier about trying to segment out just the bone parts from the rest of the wrappings, et cetera, that are on the in the mummy. But you have to keep in mind, too, that when you're doing CT scanning, it's using X-rays, and X-rays are producing densities, and that's what you're using as your imaging value. And so if your wrappings and the bitumen, the preservative material that's around the bone is so close to it's the same density as the bone, trying to segment that one from the other is very difficult to do.
Let me take a moment here to introduce again the guests. You're hearing David Hunt. He's a museum specialist at the Department of Anthropology at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. He's here visiting the campus. Also here in the studio with me is Sarah Wissman. She is director of the Program on Ancient Technologies and Archaeological Materials at University of Illinois. And I do want to mention here that our guest, David Hunt, will be giving a talk on the campus. This will be this evening at 7 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum, talking about the boy in the iron coffin. And we'll talk some more about who the boy in the iron coffin is. But you'll have two opportunities, this opportunity to hear from him, talking about some of the work that was done on a finding that was found in Washington, D.C. And then tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Sarah Wissman will be talking, and there will be a panel, actually, and Dr. Hunt will be involved in that, talking about some of the new imaging results on the Spurlock Museum's Egyptian mummy that she was just talking about. And this also is taking place at the Spurlock Museum at the Knight Auditorium. So that's tomorrow at 4. And these are both open to anybody who would like to attend. So all should feel welcome if you'd like to stop to either or both of these events. And also, I mentioned again that if you would just like to read some about the U of I mummy, what at least was known before the most recent work, you can look for a book that Sarah Wissman has written. It's titled The Virtual Mummy. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You did, based on the scans of the skull of your mummy, you had someone do a reconstruction. People, I'm sure, have seen this done. Sometimes it's done in the case where there's been a crime and you want to try to identify an individual when you don't know who that person is. It's actually possible to, if you have a skull, based on it and its dimensions, you can then, as long when you know what you're doing, you can figure out what the muscles would have been, and then you can put skin on that, and you can actually come apparently quite close to what that person actually looked like. So you have a sculptor, someone who does this kind of work, has actually done it for your mummy, so you can at least see a portrait of probably what that boy or that girl looked like.
But that has changed. Oh, and 20 years ago, we did actually have two different reconstructions. Hmm. Ray Evenhouse, who is a forensic artist and a computer expert, built up a sculpture by hand, starting with the CAT scan films as they were at that time, not digital, and built up the slices and then used tissue markers from ultrasound studies and other information to get the thickness of the flesh over the bone and information that we had at that time to recreate a sculpture for the museum exhibit in 1991. At the same time, those early CAT scans were turned into a digital reconstruction by the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And that was originally, it was spectacular for the time, because it was, we had what I called the tumbling head rotating on the screen so you could see the position of the teeth, what appeared to be an unerupted tooth or a tooth that had fallen out of the jaw. You could see the growth suture on the top of the skull. And that's why I called the book The Virtual Mummy, because using the supercomputer, you could unwrap layers. Well, now we have new reconstructions. We have much more enhanced digital images that are much higher resolution. And I have to say, no matter what we say today about this mummy on this radio show, the images are drop-dead gorgeous. So I encourage people to come to the symposium to see those. And then we also have a reconstruction by Joe Mullins, who is another forensic artist and computer expert at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Mm. And those images will be shown tomorrow. And you will see the striking similarity between the old reconstruction and the new one, but some refining of the features on the mummy child.
Mm. Well, sadly enough, there are some things radio cannot do. So here's another reason for people to stop by. So is it really, as you look at those images, the more recent ones compared to the ones that you had done in the early 90s, in how are they different?
Well, I think I'll let David talk about that because he's the physical anthropologist, and okay. He can tell you a little more about the differences this time around.
First, you have to keep in mind that in Egypt during that time period, particularly by the time of the Greco-Roman period, Egypt was a very cosmopolitan area. So you had a lot of interaction of a lot of different cultures that were coming into that area. So the so to be able to specifically identify a culture group or an ethnic group, if you want to say, or a person's ancestry would be somewhat difficult to just make the assumption that they're going to look one way or another. What you find in the panel discussion, I'll have some photographs of some of the different of children's skulls so that you can visually yourself see the CT image of the child in the wrappings. And then with the wrappings removed, you can see the skull itself and then compare it to what we have as a European child, a child of African ancestry, and a child of Central Asian ancestry. And you can see that this child that's in the wrappings looks most like the Middle Eastern or Western Asian individual more than the others. And the early ones that were done by Evenhaus were structured a little bit more to have a African ancestry look to them. Joe Mullins and I, when we were discussing this, first of all, we were following what the bone responds to. You know, that's, you know, you're putting the muscles and that kind of thing on there when you're doing the reconstruction, and so you have to follow what you actually have in front of you. And that pretty much dictated that it was more of what you would see of children that you would see today as Middle Eastern children or children who live in the central portion of Egypt, who are an amalgamation of a number of different ethnic or ancestral groups that you see.
Yeah. And isn't it true that the earliest types of forensic constructions were done using measures from cadavers, so they looked dead, whereas now you have information from ultrasound of live
CT
populations.
CT scan and yeah. MRIs, and so they're using living individuals rather than cadaveric individuals in which they were before to get the skin tissue thicknesses were taking needles and actually putting it and then when they hit bone, then they would measure that, and that would give you your skin tissue depths, but, you know, you're dealing with an individual who's now dead. Yeah. And so, yeah, they looked different.
And I remember that Ray Evenhaus at the time said, when I asked him, well, what about the soft tissue, the end of the nose and the ear shape and the lips? And he said, well, you know, that's tricky. What I did was my best possible guess.
That's still the way. There is still some artistic license that goes into that, and that's where when you look at the skull or you look at the other information that you're trying to gather to give you some indications of whether you're going to make the nose broader or shallower, taller, the lips more full. In most instances, when we're doing reconstructions at the Missing Children's Center, you want to try to avoid as much as possible indicators, unless you know what they are, of hair color, hairstyle, eye color, because in a skeleton you wouldn't have that. But in some cases, in forensic cases, you may have some remnants of information, particularly hairstyle, hair color, those kind of things that might give you some information. But ears and noses and lips are all something that has no, other than the shape of the nose, the external shape of the nose, really has no bone comparisons to go with.
Yeah.
This brings to mind something else about our mummy, the face portrait, which in our case is not that well preserved. And in other mummies, some of those Roman face portraits look like they were created yesterday. But one of the most interesting questions about Egyptian portrait mummies is, does the portrait on the outside match what you find out about the individual from using the imaging? And in many cases, yes, and in other cases, the cover to the book is completely misleading. And we think that particularly with children who maybe died very early in life before a portrait that was created for them is hanging in someone's house, that the embalming studios might have had some stock portraits. So you could easily find an example of a boy's portrait slapped on a girl mummy or vice versa.
It's really quite remarkable. I wonder if when you do this, the people who do this, you do feel a little bit like you're bringing this person back to life again.
Oh, sure. And actually, that's one of the things for, as Sarah was saying, for these children, your sixth graders that come in, they begin to recognize or realize that this is something other than just, like you said, a pot, you know, or a statue or something like that, that this is an actual human being that's in there. And to have a facial reconstruction, to have something that even connects further that this is a person inside and this was a person who lived and laughed and cried and, you know, went through life, because you see a face and you recognize that these were, you know, these were human beings.
Yeah, if we had unlimited time and unlimited money, it might be possible to do, say, a virtual reconstruction of a Roman town based on excavations in Egypt, places like Caranus done by the University of Michigan. And we have enough artifactual evidence of the kinds of things that were present in people's homes at that time. So when I wrote my fictional story of this mummy, I was trying to imagine what a house would be like and where this child lived, and then what the child might have eaten and what his family did for occupations and so forth. So we actually have a lot more information from the Roman period than, say, you do in North America, certain time periods and working in now, where you don't have the good climate preservation, you don't have all the literature preserved to help you out.
Yeah. So just one thing that seems to me of note with this mummy, at least anybody who maybe has done a little bit of reading about the embalming practices of ancient Egypt might know that one of the things that they did was that they removed some of the person's internal organs, and then those were preserved separately. And this particular mummy, at the time that this body was preserved, apparently they had stopped doing that.
They took shortcuts in the Roman period. They did not take out the brain and the viscera usually. Well, they did sometimes. But they concentrated much more on using resin to pour over the body, and then they spent most of their time on making the outside beautiful. So you want to comment on that some more?
Oh, yeah. That's as practices went along, as different time periods, the height of mummification was actually probably during the Middle Kingdom. And then you went through the third intermediate period, in which kind of things fell apart. And then when the New Kingdom came about, they were doing mummification again, but they had lost some of their techniques. And then it just kind of went downhill into the Greco-Roman period. Different time periods, you'll see a higher amount or a lower amount of percentage of mummies that have the internal organs removed. Plus, it also depended on your status and how much money you were going to put into having your mummification done. But during the Greco-Roman period, unless you really put some extra money out, generally the internal organs were left, and the brain may have been removed, but only partially removed, and often it was done by making a break in the back of the head rather than through the nose, and some of it was removed and resin was poured in to dehydrate and condense the brain tissue that might still be present.
Well, and your depicted mummy does have a fairly serious skull fracture in it. So is your thought that possibly that's where that was occurred, and it didn't have anything to do with the death of this individual, but it happened afterwards?
I think the consensus is definitely in that direction. Joe Barkmeyer, the radiologist at Carl Hospital, who helped us both times, said that he would expect to see pooled blood at the site of the injury if it was something that occurred before death. Now, of course, we can't go inside that brain and look around without damaging the mummy. There's no sign of pooled blood, and he said this time he really does think it's postmortem, and I think the other researchers agree with that. Mm-hmm. Now, exactly when that fracturing happened, I speculate, and again, this is only speculation, that maybe this child died from some kind of hit-and-run disease that didn't leave any traces in the skeleton. And if it was an epidemic of some kind, then you might have had bodies piled up waiting treatment in the embalming tent. There could have been some accidental damage or mishandling.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's something that you see. Plus, we have other mummies that come from the same time period that are positioned in the same way, as you see this child that's there at the Spurlock Museum. Also, two others we see that have damage to the backside of the head as well. And so seeing that there you have a consistency there, it probably was something that was a practice that was either done in the processing or in the embalming method. Mm.
We're talking this morning with David Hunt and Sarah Wissman, and we're having a mummy talk here on the program. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Illinois Professional Science Master's programs on the Urbana-Champaign campus, offering graduate degrees that combine science and business, including the program in agricultural production. More information is available at 217-265-5363 or on the web at psm.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with 10 different shows for you. We think of them as sort of different shows, 10 different topics every week. In the second hour, we'll not be able to do the show that we had planned. We were going to be talking about the fall veto session in Springfield. We will get that show we scheduled. So instead, we will reach into our archives and talk about a figure from American history. This is an interview we first broadcast in June with author Joshua Kendall, and we talked about his book, The Forgotten Founding Father, which is about Noah Webster, the man who is associated with the dictionary, but also had a very important role in America and American history, something that Joshua Kendall argues in this book doesn't really get acknowledged. So you'll be hearing that in the second hour today. I also do want to mention that tomorrow in our 11 o'clock hour, we'll have as our guest here in the studio, Gwendolyn Wright. She is a professor in the Graduate School of Architecture at Columbia University and is also the host of the PBS TV series History Detectives. She's visiting the campus, and we'll talk about her show and about using media to do history. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. You can get the schedule by going to the website, which is will.illinois.edu. This morning, in this hour, we have two guests, David Hunt. He's a museum specialist from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and Sarah Wissman is director of the Program on Ancient Technologies and Archaeological Materials at the University of Illinois. We're talking some about mummies and what scientists learn about them by using modern tools like the CT scan, and some about what you will hear if you go tomorrow afternoon to a symposium that will be happening on the campus, and Sarah will be a part of that, and so will David Hunt. And this is all to talk about the mummy at the Spurlock Museum and talk about what has now been learned about the mummy based on recent scans of the mummy. And also our guest will be David Hunt will be giving a talk about The Boy in the Iron Coffin. That's today at 7 o'clock tonight in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. And then the symposium is also at Spurlock at the Knight Auditorium tomorrow afternoon at 4. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I'd really want to ask David Hunt to talk a little bit about the Boy in the Iron Coffin. I don't know how much coverage it got maybe this far west. But I know just recently there was an interesting piece about it that was in the, I guess a couple of years ago, actually, a piece in the Washington Post about this find. So just give us the basics here on the Boy in the Iron Coffin.
Yeah, even though it was a couple of years ago that it transpired, it's a fascinating story, and it's also a good example of how a lot of hard work will sometimes find things that otherwise you would look at and go, well, how are we ever going to get that information? A iron coffin, and they used iron coffins back prior to Civil War, but certainly in the Civil War and post-Civil War, before steel coffins were made. Iron coffins were used primarily for shipping bodies from one place to another, but also people were buried in them. They were about 4 or 5 times the cost of making a wooden coffin, so it was usually seen as being something that would be for a higher status individual. In 2005, in northwestern Washington, D.C., they were excavating out an area to put in a new gas line and came across just underneath this gas line in between two apartment buildings this iron coffin, and come to find out that Columbia University, Columbia College, which now is a portion of and is part of George Washington University, used to be up further north, and then had the property had been sold much later. But the cemetery was that was on the college property was moved. Well, not everybody got moved. Or he may have actually been overlooked because during the Civil War, headstones often were taken to be used for other things. And so a lot of times cemeteries were lost. Mm-hmm. So this coffin was found. It was turned over to the Smithsonian, to us, actually through me, because I am the forensic anthropologist for the D.C. Medical Examiner's Office. And they called me up and says, what do we do with this? And and so, but the investigation part, looking and CT scanning, we actually CT scanned the body of the individual inside of this coffin using the CT scanner that we have on site without opening up the coffin initially.
And you thought you weren't going to see anything.
And we thought we weren't going to see anything because we figured shooting through iron, we were just going to get no signal whatsoever, but got some actually very good signal and a very interpretive signal out of it. But then we did open it because we also wanted to take samples. Unfortunately, a lot of times these iron coffins would have a nameplate that was on the outside of it. That would have helped an awful lot. But that was not, it was no longer there. And so opening it up, doing a full autopsy on the individual, and that information then was used to be able to let the genealogists and the historic archaeologist, Deborah Holwalski, spend the time, and it was their own personal time, it was not on government time, to investigate and try to find out who this was. And going through old burial records, obituaries, family histories, etc., we had narrowed it down to three individuals, of which then we asked the families on the mitochondrial end, the mother side, to donate DNA that we could then match to the boy. And we were ultimately able to identify the family by a very, very, very solid DNA match.
That's just remarkable that you could have this individual that you didn't know who he was, but that you, through really dogged work, pouring through paper records or, you know, whatever form the records are now, that you actually would be able to find a living relative mm-hmm. for this boy who apparently had been at school there and gotten sick and died and was buried there. And do I remember right that he actually was an orphan, that was part of the
difficulty? Of the problem. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was part of the problem, that he was actually orphaned by the time he was 8 or 9, which we look at now and go, gosh, that's strange. But in 150 years ago, that was a very common thing that happened, because families would die from illnesses or exposures or, you know, something like that. And children would have to go to relatives or to the to somebody who would be a supporter. And that's exactly what happened with him, is he didn't have any other family. His brothers and sisters were all doled out to other family members. They didn't take him. And so there was actually a benefactor who supported him and then gave him the money to go to school, because he had this heart defect. It was one of the things in the autopsy we identified, as he had a heart defect. So he probably wouldn't have been a really good farmhand. And so they decided that he'd be a good Baptist minister, and they sent him off to to Columbia College, and he didn't make it all the way through school.
Mm-hmm. I've seen this presentation that David Hunt is going to do tonight, or most of it, and I have to say it unrolls just like a mystery story, and the images are incredible. So I encourage people to come and hear this lecture tonight at 7, because it's a story that has a little bit of everything, and the combination of the high-tech research with the good old-fashioned plotting archival research is really neat.
Yeah. Well, this I think, again, this illustrates how much your ability to say, well, he had what was likely a congenital heart defect that probably was the cause of death, that you could do that, and you could do it without a conventional kind of autopsy. You didn't have to cut into the body to do that. You could do that using the scan to look in, and as long as with a mummy like that or body like that, or I know you have done some work on some from Peru, where the body's intact and all the internal organs are intact, then you can look inside without going inside, and I'm sure find out an awful lot of things about that individual, and perhaps also about the about what life would have been like for them and for other people at that time at that place.
Yeah, this is something that was such a that we get to do with mummies and mummies throughout the world and other colleagues who are doing similar things, and the great aspect of being able to come to the University of Illinois, too, and work with Sarah and the Spurlock Museum on the mummy that they have here, too, expands the knowledge of mummies and mummification practices and gives us that opportunity to have yet another piece of information that gives us more of the insight that you're saying and the interpretation that we can have of the prehistory that may not have otherwise been written. Mm-hmm. And that's a really fascinating thing. And yet at the same time, our technology gives us that ability to no longer have to tear these things apart, but actually be able to work. A real autopsy is really the best way to go still. No, I won't deny that. But but at the same time, you can do at these days at least 80% of what you would otherwise do in an investigation other than being able to take samples.
And that's particularly important because these mummies, particularly the Egyptian ones from the Roman period, are a very finite resource. And we know that the history of treatment of mummies before this century is pretty horrifying. I mean, people took them back from Egypt as souvenirs. They ripped the Roman face portraits out of their wrappings, so we as archaeologists lose all context, all information about where that portrait came from, which mummy, which site, and so forth. And people took the portraits back to Europe and sold them as art objects. They also took mummies back to Europe. And one of my favorite invitations from one of these early mummy books is a Lord Londonsborough having an afternoon event where he invites people to his house, and a mummy shall be unwrapped at 2:30. So they have a social occasion. They unwrap the mummy, and then they discard it. So all that information was lost to science. Hmm. So we no longer do things like that. We rely on newer technology to make these investigations, and we don't do the sort of autopsies that were common before the 1970s.
Do I remember having read somewhere that powdered mummy was something that was actually thought to have special magical and or medicinal properties?
Yeah, it was actually supposed to be good for stomach ailments.
And it also, there is a, in art, there is a particular paint color called mummy brown, which was originally made from the ground up mummy.
Seriously?
Yes.
They couldn't think of anything better to use for a pigment than ground mummy. I would think that would be kind of on the rare side. Ground mummy. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. David Hunt is here from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and also Sarah Wissman. She's director of the program on ancient technologies and archaeological materials here at U of I. And we're talking about mummies, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You all at the Smithsonian are lucky enough to have your own CT machine, so you don't have to prevail upon the generosity of a local clinic to be able to do the work. I think that I did read something recently. I hope this was indeed recent about, in fact, some of the things that you were doing on on a mummy that you had there at the Smithsonian that was one of these Peruvian mummies, the ones that were preserved because it's very cold and it's very dry, and they just became naturally mummified, but it was an intact individual, so that by doing the scan, you can learn some things about her. And as I recall, this particular one was a woman.
Yes, it's a female that we were doing quite recently. Siemens Healthcare has been a major supporter and for us, and has provided us with CT scanners and the software for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And it's been a wonderful tool to be able to do, not just for anthropology. We of course, kind of monopolize it in the sense that it's in our department. But we share its use with all of the 13 museums in the Smithsonian. We've had art objects and spacesuits and the pandas and other animals from the zoo and the Stradivarian Armati violins. And then we'll do things like dead whales and porpoise, all sorts of things. So it gets its broad range of use. When we were doing the Peruvian mummy, she is an individual that, yes, they over along the Peruvian coastline, it's quite dry, and these bodies will dry naturally. There was some cultural intervention, and sometimes they did remove the internal organs, and often they would wrap the bodies to dehydrate them faster so that it would wick the fluids away from the body. She would have been one of those variety of that style. She has internal organs, et cetera. One of the interesting things about her is that she came to the museum through an offering back, a donation back in the 1880s. And she had been acquired from another individual who had actually shipped them from Peru. And one of the ways that they made her not fall apart was they put this nice metal rod all the way from her rump up to the top of her head, which, of course, keeps her from falling apart, but, caused a little damage.
Yes, one could imagine.
Yeah. But those are, those are some of the things that you find. And the same thing when you're working with, like, we're wanting to do some study to do 3D imaging of some of the dinosaur bones. And so we had some of these that had been shipped 50, 70 years ago, and come to find out that half of it's made of plaster, and nobody really knew that, but you can see this in the CT scanner very clearly, and,
Oops.
We have a caller here, and let's get them in while we still have some time. In Hoopston, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay, it's kind of hard. I am a grandson of my Cornelius Fitzgerald from Lincoln, Illinois, who fought and lost a leg in the Civil War. It's my grandfather. He fought the 106th out of Lincoln, lost a leg at Pea Ridge and in Tennessee, hospital in Tennessee in Pea Ridge, Arkansas, come back. Got married when he was 54, and his Mary Ellen O'Hare was 24, and he was 64 years old when my mother was born in 1894.
Yes, and did you have a question? Hello?
Yes.
Yes, and did you have a question for our guests?
Well, I just thought there's not many grandsons left. And he was a very interesting individual during the Civil War, after losing his leg even, at the knee. But enjoy that program.
Okay.
Well, like everything in the Civil War.
I'll tell you something when you were talking about that. In Washington, D.C., there's the Army Medical Museum, which was started and founded during the Civil War. And one of the things that they did was in battles that were such as that, legs that were lost by the servicemen often were studied by them to try to begin to understand and develop the methods, and that was where the development of methods for surgery for trauma, particularly war trauma, was started. So your grandfather may have actually contributed at one point in time in the Army medical studies.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. We have a couple of minutes left. Just in sort of along that same line, something that I think is quite fascinating, and it goes to the point of question of what can one learn by studying mummies. And this was a story that I came across that I thought was really quite interesting. This is just recently some researchers have announced that they have found the oldest known case of prostate cancer in ancient Egypt. And it was the second oldest known case of prostate cancer in the world. So here this was an Egyptian man who had prostate cancer. He lived 2,250 years ago. And the reason that they had found it was that because of improved scanning techniques, they could see something by looking at this man's bones that they previously could not have said. And what makes it interesting is that there are people who have argued that because there apparently are not very many documented cases of cancer in the ancient world. And some people have said, well, what that tells you is that cancer is a disease of modernity. And they seem to be making the argument that there wasn't any cancer in the ancient world. And what something like this says, well, no, more than 2,000 years ago, here's a guy who had prostate cancer. And I think that's really interesting. And I'm sure that it has a lot to say about this disease that is now so significant. It's not a newcomer on the scene, apparently.
No, it's not. But we have to keep in mind that the majority of our cancers are geriatric in their where mm-hmm. they usually come out. And in earlier populations, survival was not you didn't have a high percentage of survival past, say, about 50 or 55. And so a lot of the cancers, particularly like prostate cancer, is something that would not be seen in the archaeological record as much, primarily because many people didn't live to be older ages in which this would have shown up. You still see cancers in earlier populations. It's not that it doesn't exist, but it is a rarer occurrence to be seen. Because of preservation and because of age.
Mm. Well, Egyptian mummies have produced signs of other disease. Cardiovascular disease has made the news several times recently, so that newer scans have shown signs of, you know, hardening of the arteries in Egyptian mummies. And some of the studies going as far back as the 70s, the Manchester University Museum in Manchester, England, when they examined the intestines of some of their mummies, they found evidence of intestinal parasites, schistosomiasis. They looked at spines and found scoliosis and other things. So there's a lot of interesting evidence on disease. And there's a whole group of people, a society of paleopathologists who investigate this kind of thing.
And diabetes, the sural nerves in the ankle have been looked at for evidence of changes that take place that you see from the decay or destruction that takes place due to diabetes and other types of circulatory problems. There have been many different things that have been found, and you're absolutely right. As technology gets better and better and newer technique can be used, more and more of this will be found and being able to be discerned.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. And I do want to mention one more time, though, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more on these subjects, you can hear our guest, Dr. David Hunt, talking about the boy in the iron coffin. He talked a little bit earlier about that story. This is a lecture that he'll be giving at the Spurlock Museum on the campus. It's at Knight Auditorium. That's tonight at 7 o'clock. And then if you'd like to hear more about the return of the mummy and what has been learned now about the Spurlock mummy, they'll both be involved. Sarah Wisman and David Hunt will be involved in this. And this will be taking place also at the Knight Auditorium, Spurlock, at 4 tomorrow afternoon. And these things are open to the public, and anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And maybe you might want to take a look at some of Sarah Wisman's archaeological mysteries. There are four of them. And also, she's written a book about the U of I's mummy, which is published by the University of Illinois Press. That's The Virtual Mummy. So that's out there as well. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
David Hunt from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and Sarah Wisman, she's director of the Program on Ancient Technologies and Archaeological Materials at the U of I.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education, providing for musicians of all ages in over 200 school music programs. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
We'll take a break, as we usually do at this point, so we can bring you an update on the markets, and we'll be back. Stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM. Now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/FarmerView.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade, and in Kansas City. The markets are on the downside, but they have bounced back off lows made earlier this morning as end users are stepping into the marketplace and buying grain on bottom picking ideas. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat at 7.18 and 3 quarters is down 6 and a quarter. May at 7.46 and 3 quarters down 2. December wheat